Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Consumers, businesses, and localities are getting ready as New York State's plastic bag ban takes effect March 1st. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation has released final regulations to implement the New York State Plastic Bag Waste Reduction Act, which goes into effect next month. DEC Chief of Staff Sean Mahar.
March 1st is the big day, and all New Yorkers should be prepared that starting that day, single-use plastic bags will not be allowed to be provided at certain retail outfits as defined in the legislation. We are going to be working over the coming months on a very robust education campaign. The education campaign is very much underway right now, but our goal is to make sure that there's a smooth transition for consumers and affected retailers with this ban. So we're going to continue that education effort. Enforcement will follow in the months ahead, but we want to give a period of transition so everyone can come into compliance here. But as of March 1st, single-use plastic bags are prohibited.
Democratic State Assemblywoman Pat Fahey of the 109th District has long championed the ban.
We have, in New York alone, been using 23 billion bags each year. So it's time to move away from plastic to do what we can for the environment. In the meantime, the regs have just come out that the regulations, the final regulations from DEC, I wish they'd come out a little sooner, and I wish that we were doing more press on this. I myself am going to try to keep putting it out there to get folks ready. There is a little bit of concern from a number of environmentalist groups. There is a little wiggle room, if you will, on thickness of plastic. And we really just want to move away from plastic bags and move toward reusable bags, even if some of those may be made of recycled plastic content. But they are the reusable, and we want to make sure that we don't see stores gaining it, if you will, by just giving away thicker, slightly thicker plastic bags.
Fahey hopes people will become comfortable with reusable totes, negating the need for paper bags.
We're hoping nobody will have to pay a 5-cent fee. We want folks using reusable bags. So start stocking up now.
Albany Common Councilor Richard Conte says the ban will particularly affect his 6th Ward constituents.
I don't think people have thought about it. When I go to the grocery store, we go in with our reusable bags, but we often see people coming out with big carts full of plastic bags. So these are folks that have not thought about it, aren't thinking about it, don't do that, and they don't probably have a supply of reusable bags. It's going to be taking some getting used to. The other aspect of this, I mean, we keep on talking about it in terms of grocery stores and grocery bags, but its applicability is wider than that to, retail establishments. Any establishment that charges sales tax, so any like the retail stores, Macy's, Kohl's, all those big department stores, they need to also convert to some type of a reusable bag or non-plastic bag. I'm not sure what they're going to do. But I don't know to what extent people understand the wider applicability beyond just grocery stores that the ban has.
Mahar directs anyone uncertain about the ban to view specially prepared material available on the DEC website. There's a link at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, you've warned all along in your conversation with Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York. He warned about this. Do not think that beating Trump is easy. We see polls that say any of these Democrats could beat Trump, but I guess not so fast, right?
That's right, David. Look, there are many people who believe that Trump is going to win. And as you know, Kellyanne Conway tweeted last night, because of the quality of the debate and how angry it was, why don't you people keep going for another hour? Obviously, he's sitting there, he's watching it, he's in communication with her, and that seems to be where they are. I think that they didn't do themselves any good last night, that's for sure.
Let's go a little further with your interview with Governor Andrew Cuomo yesterday.
Please.
He had quite a time trying to reframe the budget narrative, and this had to do a lot with the press because, as he put it, the times are so political and so episodic and topical, it's that what's happening with this budget is the elephant is being lost for the tail. He pointed out how the press bands together, and you pointed out that even WAMC and you were criticized for being one of the places the governor goes and that other places shouldn't cover it. And he said, well, why don't you follow me around? Why do you stay in the red room and wait for me to show up for you?
Yes, it was an interesting to-do. There was one fellow who tweeted that during the last appearance of the governor that people shouldn't quote WAMC, and which I was infuriated by, to be honest with you. I just thought it was crazy. You know, you don't start saying, don't cover him because we want him in the red room. But I did go out of my way to ask the governor about why he isn't doing more press conferences. And that's what he said. You're welcome to come along with me. Basically, you're too lazy, you don't do it. I don't know if that has any merit at all. I'd like to see him doing full press conferences. On the other hand, I don't want competitors for the news to be saying, don't quote them. When that happens, it's most unseemly. I haven't shut up about it since it happened, and I intend to keep going.
You had an interesting discussion with the head of the Assembly Health Committee, longest tenured legislator in the history of New York. Richard Gottfried.
My friend Dick Gottfried. He's been there forever. He was the youngest, and now he's the longest serving. He made the point that John Markey was a senator from Staten Island who had been there for a long, long time. He said, yeah, but there was a question of a leap year, therefore I'm the longest serving.
By a day.
That's pretty funny. Look, he's got a plan to have universal health care in New York alone. The governor says, no, you got to do it nationally. Got to start somewhere. I think somewhere between the two of them is the truth. I love the idea that a state will come up with a plan. I know Massachusetts did. Almost everybody in Massachusetts is covered. One would think it could be done in New York State also. I think Gottfried has a point. On the other hand, you got a governor with a $6 billion budget shortfall, and he's trying to put that on the counties for the way in which Medicaid is dispersed, saying that basically we've gotten way too generous. Obviously, the counties don't like it because it'll affect their budgets, and they will fight back like crazy, but they will do it in a subterranean way because you don't want to get Andrew mad, that's for sure.
The study is out now that shows that New York and New Jersey face the largest population decrease in the U.S. You've had discussions with the governor this week, of course, with Richard Gottfried, about the idea, for example, you mentioned just a moment ago, universal health care in New York, which would raise taxes. And would that force people to flee? We're seeing the numbers. Gottfried played it down. And we know that the president and other prominent New Yorkers like Golisano have left, claiming it's because the taxes are too high.
Well, I think there are two major reasons people go south. One of them is that Florida is a low-tax state, although it does cost a lot to register your car, I understand. But it's a low-tax state. And number two, it's cold. Nobody likes to be cold. And, you know, one of the great advantages of the southern states is you go there because you won't be shivering all the time. So if you raise the taxes, there is no question you will lose some people. Let's face it. A lot of New Yorkers want the services that higher taxes will bring. And a lot of them have had their kids and the kids gone to school and they paid their taxes. And now they say, okay, now I'm going to move. I consider that to be somewhat selfish. I'm proud to pay our taxes in Massachusetts, which are quite high, because I do believe in the value of schools. And when something like the Berkshire Hills regional system comes up and it's a question of building another school, I'm always for it, and I don't mind paying that. There are many others who do not. So you can see it pretty well written out right before you, that people get tired of paying taxes, and if there's a way to avoid them, they avoid them. And when you raise them, they'll move. It's really quite simple.
Well, this week, the head of ICE was here in New York, in Troy. You've got this whole bail reform, the president and the Trusted Traveler program, and targeting New York because it's allowing undocumented immigrants under its green light law to get driver's licenses.
Well, that's right. That's what this governor... That's right, David. That's what this president has said. We know what this is all about. At least I do. is keep America white. That's what this guy wants, what Trump wants, so that when you close the borders, Latinos and others will be kept out because there's a majority coming of black and Hispanic people in the United States. And what this is all about is putting a stop to that on the president's part. It's disgusting, but it's what he's doing. So that when you see the people from ICE showing up and you see all of that, that all goes towards the same goal, which is to scare people and otherwise. Now, we know that New York, Massachusetts, California have been targeted to lose some of the tax advantages that they have enjoyed in the past. You could deduct your state and local taxes, for example. After $10,000, you can't do that anymore. And this president has been unremitting in what he has done. He just never stopped going after New York and California, Massachusetts, and the big blue states just to punish them. Can you imagine a president who exists to punish people?
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy this week under the weight of hundreds of childhood sexual abuse cases filed against the organization. An attorney for 75 cases in New York says the news is a mixed bag for its clients. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has more.
Seattle-based attorney Jason Amala says the news that the Boy Scouts of America has filed for bankruptcy is a form of validation for his clients, because he says the declaration means the national organization is admitting that many of the incidents are real.
It's good news because it's difficult for the Boy Scouts to claim they didn't have a big problem if they're filing for bankruptcy over the problem, right? So on some level, this is the Boy Scouts accepting responsibility for what happened.
But on the downside, it also means that many of the confidential files on abuse allegations, which were kept by the Boy Scouts since the 1920s, might not be accessible to survivors and their attorneys who are trying to build a case.
The files that are out there are incomplete. They only go from 1965 until the early 1990s.
Amala says it's important for survivors to know that there will still be money available to pay settlements in lawsuits, even though the Boy Scouts are going bankrupt.
A lot of people think bankruptcy means they're going to get nothing, so what's the point of filing a claim? That's just 100% not true and not accurate. The Boy Scouts have reported over $1 billion in assets, and that doesn't include their insurance. The purpose of a bankruptcy like this, just like the Catholic bankruptcies, is basically to ask a bankruptcy judge to give a timeout, to pause all of the cases that have already been filed, and to pause the cases that could be filed in state court. And what that means is that anyone who has a claim against the Boy Scouts, they're going to have a limited time to file a claim in the bankruptcy court.
The bankruptcy judge could further limit the time some New York survivors have to file lawsuits. Under the state's Child Victims Act, those over 55 who have aged out of the statute of limitations have a one-year window of opportunity to file civil cases. That window ends August 14th, but the judge could potentially set an even smaller window to accept new cases. Local Boy Scout councils around the state have so far not followed the lead of the national organization. They remain solvent, although Amala says it's likely that many will file bankruptcy in the coming days. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in Albany recently to promote new legislation intended to help families struggling with addiction. The Legislative Gazette's Jackie Orchard reports.
Gillibrand says the Family Support Services for Addiction Act would allocate $25 million to help nonprofit organizations, like the Addictions Care Center of Albany, to provide support services to families of people seeking treatment. Gillibrand says more than 3,000 people in New York State died from an opioid overdose in 2017. The Democrat says it's important to get families involved because studies show people are more likely to stay in treatment and recover.
They need referrals to credible and helpful treatment providers. They need support groups.
The Addictions Care Center of Albany administers the Family Support Navigator Program, which focuses on family issues resulting from addiction. Kelly Farenkoff is the group's clinical director of residential services. She says patients often end up back home for recovery, which is why family education is so important. But the Albany facility also offers on-campus treatment.
We have it all under one roof for them. So we are able to have that enforcement through both sides. We have them right across the street. So we're here, they're in another building. So if families come in, families are able, they are able to connect with us immediately to help try to get the client into any sort of help that's needed.
Farenkoff says the current program lacks the funds to keep families involved.
We struggle with having families get the resources. So the more money that's out there to help them so they can get that, the forward, to push it forward for them is needed. We struggle with oftentimes having families, we lose connections with families based off the fact that we lose the client. And we really want to help that, to keep that unity together, because we know that addiction affects the whole family, not just the client themselves.
Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple says the Addiction Care Center of Albany has made his job easier. Apple says last year there were roughly 200 overdoses in the county, many of them repeat incidents. Apple says departments like his know they can't arrest their way out of the addiction crisis.
We shopped all over the place when we were losing people daily to overdoses. We shopped all over. We need help from somebody out there. We didn't know what we were doing. We're a police officer, an organization, law enforcement. All we knew at that point was let's try to arrest our way out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Just put them in jail, put them in jail. We were fortunate enough to start a treatment center with Addictions Care Center, and they became our partner because they didn't want to know how they were going to get paid. I'll never forget Keith saying, let's save some lives and we'll figure out how to get paid later.
The proposed funding would be used for peer support groups, training for family members, education on substance use disorder for schools, medical information, and referrals. The bill is co-sponsored by Republican U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, but Senator Gillibrand says this is only the beginning.
It's not nearly enough. It's literally a drop in the bucket. But it's a good start, and it's bipartisan, so we have the opportunity, hopefully, to pass the bill this year.
You can find more information about the Addictions Care Center of Albany at WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jackie Orchard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us again on the Legislative Gazette is Dr. Lynn Porodnik, a medical marijuana doctor in New York State. She shares her expertise and keeps us up to date. As we now see, the governor has put legalizing marijuana legislation in the state budget. Hello, Lynn.
David, how are you?
I am wonderful, and it's good to talk to you again about an issue that is gaining steam, at least it seems, in terms of legislation. We know that the governor has, as I just said, put it in the budget. We know that the state is got a $6 billion budget gap they need to fill. And one of the reasons the governor certainly is pushing legalization is for the revenue it could bring in. We also have the issue of whether it will actually get passed. There's been some resistance to legalization in New York, including contingent of legislators on Long Island the governor has spoken about. But we have also seen a change of heart for legislators, many of them coming around on this issue. The governor even said, quote, he evolved on the issue of legalizing marijuana. And then there's this amazing profile from the New York Times that has the headline, Get Well or Die, a state senator reveals his hidden addiction battle. And this is Senator Peter Harkin, and quite a story that he has to tell. And he tells it as he pushes and now agrees with this legalization attempt.
I think it's amazing he's come out of the closet about his personal struggles. And I give him so much credit for succeeding and being verbal about it, because there's so much stigma about drug usage and mistakes people have made. Also, Peter Harkin is going to be the chair of the Recreation Committee. He now has alcohol and tobacco, so he really can have strong impact with the program, and he really believes it. And he's responsible for a lot of the opioid panels and discussions that are going on. So I think he is strong presence, willing to make changes, and can really get a lot of momentum going. And hopefully REC will pass in April, and there's a lot of momentum behind it. There are protests in Albany or people showing their opinions, and all this makes impact. I actually participate in a group called Canagather. They'll be having their first Albany gathering on 226 at the Renaissance Albany Hotel. And they're all about legalization under a regulated format that helps people. And they're also very involved with social equity. So this is something that people can actually become involved in if they believe in it. And it's open to anybody and everyone. And it, strange as it sounds, there's so much impact on everybody. If you have a friend or a family member that's sick, suddenly you become interested in medical marijuana to help these people. I have a patient who's a former Marine who was in drug enforcement, enjoyed busting people for selling pot. He's in his 90s now, and he uses medical marijuana for pain management. He hates opioids.
And Lynn, go a little further to explain to our listeners, if they don't know what this means, but when you say equal opportunity and leveling the playing field when it comes to legalizing the drug, what are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about that it seems that people of color have been incarcerated under the Rockefeller laws, all the search and frisk, and minority people have not been able to make changes. They've had these criminal records, which are now being expunged, and it's time to move forward and provide jobs to these people who've been harmed under these laws and this draconian approach. So there is a lot of social equity that's being attempted in New York. They're trying to give jobs and help minorities get into this program at all different levels, whether it's as a messenger in a grow facility, but it's all besides tax revenue. It's seen as a way to give employment to people who otherwise aren't finding it, who would like to work. And many are interested in marijuana. They're experienced, and they would love to participate. So this whole recreational bill, the impact is much more than just having pot. It's creating jobs and opportunity for people who have been put down in the past who haven't had opportunities.
You and I stay in touch on these issues, and you sent me a note not so long ago that you had a meeting with the recreational czar of New York. What did you learn in that meeting?
I learned a lot, that April's going to be the time when this is going to either fly or not. And also I learned a lot about the rules and regulations, the way things are written up. And it seems that there's a real need for co-op farms. I've met with a group that has a co-op farm in Washington County, that's Cambridge, New York, and there's a farm co-op going on under John Ubaldo, who was a former Wall Street bond trader after 9/11, gave up Wall Street and bought a farm. He's now has a dairy farm and a retail outlet in Bedford, New York, where he grew up. He's organized 10 farmers at this point to do a co-op with alternating hemp in there, as well as barley and grains for livestock. So this program would actually serve the county. The farmers are leaving their properties. The younger generation is not interested in sticking around for that life. But growing hemp and growing marijuana, they see as something that could be profitable, and they're interested in doing. This area is also really depressed due to opioid usage, and it seems to be the center of illicit growth in New York, which is something we had no clue about. So it seems like the black sheep farmer of every family kind of has a backyard grow, and they know how to do it. So New York is very interested in the project because it's job opportunity, farm co-op, and getting rid of the illicit market. In California, there's a huge, huge glut of illicit growth in many of the other states. So really, New York would love to incorporate the illicit side into the recreational side in a regulated manner. And that's a huge undertaking.
It certainly is, right, Lynn? Because that would assume a couple of things. Number one, they would probably have to reduce their prices. It seems like the pricing with the taxes that have been put out in other states like Massachusetts put it far above the illicit market. And then, you know, there's this whole issue about whether everyone can grow it or not, and whether that would level the playing field and take some of the illicit market out of it or add to it.
Well, this particular project's interesting because it's a co-op, so they don't really have to buy many farm and major agricultural investments. It's all set up. And as a co-op, they share machinery. So not everybody has to have that, you know, $500,000 outlay for the right machinery to harvest. And they also work together because the harvesting can be really, really intense. Everybody's like coming in at the same time. So it's a group of people, and then there's 20 other farms on the wait list. So this New York State is looking at this model as a paradigm of what can be. And if it works out, they're hoping that many other co-ops will form and get into this.
So with your ear to the ground and hearing from folks who are involved with the legislation, from folks who are involved with rallying around the legislation, from your patients and from all that you know right now at this moment, you look into your crystal ball, Dr. Porodnik, and you say New York will or will not have legal recreational marijuana after the April 1st deadline for the budget.
I think it's going to happen. If it doesn't happen now, it's not going to happen for a really long time. There's a lot of momentum out there. There are a lot of people involved. And the state has a huge budget gap. Is it going to fill the whole gap? No. But if it provides employment, gets people out of their homes, working, productive, that's huge. And as far as the black market, it will always be there. But if New York can incorporate the black market, meaning giving licenses, having these people using their expertise, they'll be a step ahead of many other states.
Dr. Lynn Porodnik, medical marijuana doctor in New York State, joins us from time to time to talk about this issue. And I'm sure we'll be gathering again, certainly if the legislation passes. Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks, David.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2008. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.